Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. The debate over whether to reopen schools for in-person learning has been one of the most contentious issues of the past year. But amid all the back and forth on remote versus in-person schooling, one troubling trend has emerged. Many students have stopped attending school completely. One estimate from the nonprofit group Bellwether Education Partners found that schools lost touch with as many as 3 million marginalized students between the start of the pandemic and the fall of 2020. Those students include children in the foster care system, English language learners, and children with disabilities. In Broward County, Florida, which is the second largest school district in that state, officials have found that about 800 students are no longer going to class. And in an attempt to get these children back into the system, some social workers in the district have been going door to door.
There's a lot of instances where we don't have the phone numbers. We don't have any contact information, so that's where we have to hit the pavement and go to the homes and knock on those doors to see if the kids, and it's also a wellness check, because if we haven't heard from a kid, they have not logged in, we want to make sure that they're okay.
That's Lilia Francois, a social worker with the Broward School District, and reporter Veronica Saragovia spoke to her for WLRN's Class of COVID-19 project, which is about the education crisis for Florida's vulnerable students today. And Veronica joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Veronica, 800 kids are missing in the Broward County School District. What are the typical reasons why that you've heard that they have not shown up to school?
Well, it started with a lot of shifting of start dates for schools and e-learning software that didn't work. And so that started leaving out a lot of students and frustrated parents. And then there are also so many who are facing housing instability, parents who work really tough schedules and can't be there to oversee their learning progress, and families who are struggling to buy enough food or to afford childcare. So it's a lot of issues that are keeping them from going to school consistently.
How are you able to, well, how are the school district or the social workers that you've spoken to able to track these students down? We heard a little bit from your interview with the social worker, Lilia Francois. Tell us more about that.
Well, it first starts with a teacher reaching out to a parent. And then when a teacher isn't able to get through or to find the parent and the student, then they'll involve the school, that grade administrator and a guidance counselor. And by the time a social worker like Lilia Francois gets involved, the school has tried everything, reaching out to emergency contacts like grandparents, asking classmates if they know where the student is. So then she'll get in, someone like Lilia will get in the car and go find the students at the home that they have on record.
Have these social work visits and these wellness checks been successful largely, or do they still turn up without being able to find the children?
There are students who, I would say that they're able to locate them. You know, there's about 800 students who completely stopped going to school in Broward County. So there might be students who have either moved out of state. There are students who moved to another school, or some are doing homeschooling. Some have been able to go to private schools. But then there are, I mean, we've, in the Class of COVID-19 project, we've covered, one of my colleagues covered migrant family students who have been hard to track down. So some of them, unfortunately, might not be able to connect with.
Do we know, I mean, you mentioned a lot of different options. Some of these students might be being homeschooled. Some of them may have moved. We know lots of people moved during the pandemic. But I am particularly concerned about students who fall off of the radar, who are in homes where they could be experiencing anything, different types of abuse, or not having the type of family structure that will, you know, allow for homeschooling. Or, as you mentioned earlier, some of these students may be homeless. Do we know how many of the students that are going unaccounted for are in those types of situations?
Well, we know that the school superintendent in Broward County, Robert Runcie, said about 59,000 students aren't making enough progress academically, and about two-thirds are low-income students, nearly a quarter have disabilities. I don't know within this number of students who are really struggling how many are homeless, but that's a huge issue that's impacting people in South Florida and across the country, where they are either being evicted, or they're moving in with relatives, or they're living week to week in motels. That's a huge issue in the state of Florida, especially in Central Florida, in the Orlando area. So because the term of homelessness is so complicated and broad, it's a hard number to pin down. But this student who when I shadowed Lilia Francois, she had gone first to a home that they had on record, and they weren't living there anymore. And so I witnessed how then Lilia started making calls and found the right home that we went to, and then she found the family.
How was the student? What had happened to that particular student?
The student, according to her mother, Maria, she didn't feel at first, she felt fearful of going back to school because of the coronavirus. And they also said that she didn't have access to a laptop and that she didn't have internet for quite a bit of time because the mother has been unemployed for a lot of the pandemic. And so there was a communication barrier. Language barriers play a huge role. She said she wasn't receiving information in Spanish. And the school district has communicated about multiple opportunities to pick up laptops, but there was just a lot of missed opportunities to connect with her. And finally, then Lilia Francois made it to her home with a laptop.
Veronica, does the Broward County Schools District have a plan to deal with the gap in achievement that some of these students may be dealing with if they've been gone for a while?
Yes, the social workers play critical roles in this because they do everything from bringing laptops and teaching students how to log on all the way to being intervening in mental health crises. And I think they're depending a lot on social workers to help bring them back. They're also, from what I observed, taking an approach that doesn't have punitive measures, and they're just trying and trying and trying. And Lilia Francois told me she was even going to that home to test what bus route this student could take to get to another school that would be closer to the home that they moved to. And so they're just trying, they're offering help with connecting to internet. And they told me about deals that the internet providers here have so that can make Wi-Fi affordable for students in public school systems. And so I think they're trying as much as possible to offer. They offer peers who would be tutors to the students. And now this student, Marjorie, has been able to, for about 9-10 months, she wasn't enrolled in any school. And I learned that very recently she's now enrolled in a charter school that offers vocational training and one-on-one education. So, and this is, I would say, a huge part of Lilia Francois's work, that she made sure this student would be back in school.
Veronica Saragovia is a reporter for WLRN in Miami. Veronica, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Broward County is just one of the many school districts struggling to make sure that vulnerable students don't fall out of the education system altogether during the pandemic. With me now to talk about how districts are responding nationwide is Erin Einhorn, a national reporter for NBC News Digital. Erin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me and for focusing on this issue.
We mentioned that as many as 3 million vulnerable students may have stopped attending school completely during the pandemic. What does this tell us about, what do we know about who these students are nationally?
Yeah, as Veronica said, you know, in Broward, you know, some of those students might be in private school, some of them might be homeschooling. But a lot of them, you know, appear just not to be in school at all. And, you know, by vulnerable, we mean children with special needs, children who don't speak English well, who their parents don't speak English well, they're learning to speak English, they might be homeless, they might be in foster care. The students who, you know, who were, as in the Broward example, you know, least likely to get the message about, okay, school's virtual this year, but it's happening, and here's how you get a laptop, and here's how you get connected, and here's, you know, how you get what you need to keep your child in class. I mean, a lot of these families are just so overwhelmed that the logistics of getting their children connected is just, you know, so overwhelming, and they might not even realize that they're supposed to be in school.
How much of this has to do, and I'm looking at this from the perspective of someone who's in myself, I'm in New York City, and I know that we've gone back and forth on opening and closing, depending on infection rates. How much of this, of these students sort of falling through the cracks here is because of the inconsistency that many of the schools across the country have been facing about whether in-person learning or remote learning?
I mean, look, the schools are inconsistent, and so are the lives of many of the families affected. You know, I mean, the rate of child hunger at a time when, you know, even schools that are open might not be providing consistent free lunches, and, you know, housing instability for families with children is higher than it's been in an awfully long time. And, you know, all of those different things, parents may have lost their jobs, they may have become sick, they may have lost a loved one who was supporting the family, all of those different things that families need as, you know, as support, you know, could be disrupted. And then, you know, if the school's hybrid, okay, you got to keep track. Okay, it's Monday and Wednesday, or, you know, you got to keep track of some schedule, or it's open this week, but oh no, now there's a case and everybody's quarantining, and it's a lot, even for families, you know, who have all the resources.
And we also know that there have been higher rates of absences, not just total disappearances, but absences. Are we seeing that as well? More students just not being in class for extended amounts of time?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even before the pandemic, you know, it was something like 8 million children, 1 in 7 were chronically absent, meaning missing 10% of school days, which, you know, is an indicator of all kinds of other, you know, challenges in the children's lives, but also a predictor, right? If you're not going to read by third grade, you're going to fail classes in middle school, you're going to drop out in high school. And, you know, while there's no national attendance data to say what that looks like now, you know, districts that have released numbers, you know, that number has doubled, which means 16 million kids, or 1 in 5.
And you're saying that there has been a significant increase in students who are also chronically absent. Is that right?
Yeah. And not only that, but, you know, a lot of states during the pandemic have changed how they define attendance in the first place. So maybe you log in once a day and you're marked present. But, you know, anyone who's got kids doing virtual school know that just because you're logged in doesn't mean, you know, you might have glitchy internet, or someone's running the vacuum, or there's a baby screaming, or, you know, they can't, or they just can't sit that long. So, you know, you can be connected, but, you know, are you listening? Are you learning? Are you really present? You know, there's so many other things going on.
Erin, one of the things that, you know, we've sort of mentioned in the first segment were that some of these students may have ended up in private school. Some of them may be homeschooled. Some of them may, their parents may have left. But I'm particularly also concerned about the students whose safety might be at risk. Schools are often a place where educators are trained to spot things like malnutrition and physical abuse and other types of abuse. What happens to these students? I mean, it worries me that there are children who could be in very dangerous scenarios right now, and no one is available there to help them. Do we know whether there are programs similar to what's happening in Broward, where social services folks are sent out or wellness checks are happening?
I mean, certainly lots of districts are doing the best that they can, but, you know, they, you know, not every district has the resources to go door to door, or, you know, then the number of students they who need help might be higher than their resources exist. And we, you know, and just, you know, with enrollment down, you know, most states in this country fund schools on a per pupil basis. So you have fewer children this year, you're going to get less money next year, you're going to have fewer resources, and we're going to have all these kids showing up who've missed a year of school. And they're not just behind academically, they've experienced trauma, you know, they've lost loved ones, they've seen their parents struggling, they're going to show up at school, all of this is going to be landing on schools next fall or whenever we're back to normal. Those schools are going to need more resources than they needed before. And, you know, unless we significantly change the way we fund schools, they're going to have less money, fewer people to help these kids.
Erin, the Biden administration from the beginning, has made it reopening schools, I should say, a priority. They've since walked that back a little bit, saying that they're hoping to reopen schools, maybe not 5 days a week, maybe 1 day a week for in-person learning. But has the Biden administration released any plans that specifically address the attendance issues in schools that we're talking about today?
I mean, there's a lot of different plans and there's a sort of ambitious proposals, but all of that's going to be subject to congressional approval. You know, there's the actual sausage making process behind any legislation that's going to need to fund it. So we're all going to have to see where that plays out, you know, without sort of saying I'm certain the administration is aware of the problems facing schools and the resources they're going to need. You know, but how they prioritize that and also how that gets distributed. You know, the money goes through the states and the states might have some control over how to use the money or how to prioritize, which schools will get the priority and things like that. So we're all going to have to see how that plays out.
We also know that Black and Latino parents have concerns about some of their kids returning to in-person learning because of a lack of trust in the education system. Do we know whether or not that may have factored into a lot of some of these students who are missing?
Well, absolutely. I mean, a lot of Black children, Native children, Latinos, first of all, they've taken the brunt of the pandemic. You know, a lot of their parents are the frontline workers. They've been exposed to the virus. Those communities in many parts of the country have been hit really hard. They've seen many people that they love die from COVID. So they're not going to take a risk and send their children into a school, you know, after years of, you know, these, you know, especially in the urban areas, these are the schools that have the fewest resources and the least experienced teachers. They have many years of evidence that they should be skeptical about how their children are going to be treated in school. And they're older buildings in a lot of cities. You know, they're deteriorated. The infrastructure has deteriorated. They might not have windows that open. They might not have good ventilation. They may not be the best place to send your child to school during a pandemic. And, you know, it requires a lot of trust. And that trust has been, you know, eroded. And, you know, how do you build that back, you know, at a time like this?
Do we have a sense of what some of the long-term effects could be on the students who may, you know, have this huge gap their learning may be disrupted for even longer time than we expected?
I mean, I don't think anybody knows for sure. I mean, we certainly know what happens when children fall behind. You know, you fall a little bit behind and, you know, that erodes your self-esteem, and then you start feeling bad about yourself and you become less motivated. You know, maybe it's different if there's, you know, more kids in that situation with you. You know, are we going to keep the same standards and expectations we always had? You know, if we had a standard that said, you know, children need to be able to have this skill by third grade and that skill by sixth grade, are we going to hold children to that on, you know, the standardized testing, and, you know, we're going to grade the schools and shut them down if they're not succeeding and fire their teachers and all these things? Are we going to use all those same standards that we had before, like none of this happened? And those are all policy decisions that are going to play out differently in different states.
Like I said, I really hope that we can sort some of this out because there are real lives at stake here. So thank you for your reporting. Erin Einhorn is a national reporter for NBC News Digital. Erin, thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Hi, this is Letitia from Brockton. As a parent, my biggest struggle with remote learning right now is finding that balance between, oh my goodness, my child is being left behind because they're not learning anything or they're not reading a book, I don't know what they're doing, and oh, it's snowing. You know what? Why don't you go outside and play and have a snow day and I'll just tell your teacher you're not coming in. So I'm finding it really hard to let them have a childhood, but then also maintain a good learning education.
This is Gina. I live in Florida. I'm a parent of remote or e-learners, we call them. Our teachers are doing a great job considering these challenges they have. I don't work right now, though I could. I'm grateful that I can spend more time with my children, though overseeing schoolwork has been difficult. My 9-year-old is doing well with learning the required studies, but suffers greatly in developmental socializing. He is also so impulsive and has a hard time resisting the internet always at his fingertips. I have to watch carefully and can't do much with chores or work around the house. Our 16-year-old feels isolated and would rather ghost teachers. I can't see sending my children back to in-person school right now since new variants are spreading like wildfire. I have asthma and cardiac issues, so I'm high risk.
My name is Natalie, and I'm calling from San Diego, California. And I keep hearing about stories of parents and teachers who are struggling with remote learning. And the thing I keep running into is there are a lot of kids out there that actually are thriving in remote learning. And I don't feel that that is covered very much. It's almost like it's underreported. And there are quite a few kids that are thriving, especially introverted students or students that maybe didn't quite do well at school in the classical classroom setting. And as a teacher, it is exciting to see that there are kids thriving in it.
This is Rachel from Louisville, Kentucky. My biggest struggle with remote learning is that it's all done through a Chromebook that is managed by the school system. I can't control what apps, what websites he's allowed to go to. And I've discovered that even though it looks like he's in class on a separate tab, he's going to other websites, some of which he really shouldn't be going to, and listening to other things and doing other things instead of doing his work.
And we also heard from some teachers.
My name's Jenna. I teach at a private preschool in Washington State. We are currently online using a combination of Zoom meetings and prepared learning packets that the families take home every week. And my biggest challenge is not being able to give my students the kind of hands-on experience that is developmentally appropriate for preschoolers. Most parents don't have the number of school supplies, of art supplies that we have on hand, and frequently they don't choose to let their children have the kind of messy exploration that we can have in the classroom. And they also don't get the opportunity to have those explorations with their peers, which is really important for learning at the preschool stage.
Keep sharing your thoughts with us. Remember, you can always send us a voice memo at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. You can also give us a call at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by Progressive Insurance, with the Name Your Price tool offering a range of coverage and price options to choose from. Now that's Progressive. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
The media landscape is changing, and big jobs are going empty at news organizations across the country. From the Washington Post to the New York Times to HuffPost to the LA Times and beyond, many outlets are looking for new editors right now. We're going to talk about why with Sarah Ellison, a staff writer for the Washington Post who covers media and politics. Sarah, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So, two publications, two newspapers, the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times, have recently announced pretty big departures. Marty Baron leaving the Post, Norm Perlstein leaving the Times. These are men who've been in these positions. In fact, Norman came out of retirement to go back to the LA Times. How surprising were these departures?
Well, in Marty Baron's case, he had alerted everyone 2 years ago that he was going to retire after the presidential election. And it's a normal time in a news organization for places to sort of take stock and change, not just leadership, but different, you know, White House reporters leave their beats, different people move around. But nonetheless, when Marty announced his retirement, he announced it with a 1 month lead time. So he announced it at the end of January and he was leaving at the end of February. So even though we were expecting that to come, it was still a bit of a shock, partly because he's been such a transformative leader at the Post. Norm's departure announcement came really amid a kind of newsroom uprising and revolt about the lack of diversity in the entire Los Angeles Times newsroom. And that was a real call from that newsroom, that they wanted their newsroom to reflect the community that they cover. And really, they felt like it didn't. And Norm is an excellent leader. He has led newsrooms from the Wall Street Journal to Time Inc. to Bloomberg Businessweek. He's somebody who has retired. I mean, he'll say this himself. He's retired from more jobs than most people have had. And so here's somebody who definitely knew how to do the job, but he was an older white man who was running a newspaper and writing the ship, but he was running a newspaper that is reflecting a city and covering a city that is broadly diverse, young, changing demographically. And so his departure was less of a surprise, but it was a real signal that things were going to change dramatically.
There have also been, we actually did some reporting around the LA Times and many of the Latino reporters there who had gathered to, you know, ask for more diversity, particularly given the demographics, as you mentioned, Sarah, of some of the largest cities in the state of California, particularly in LA. The New York Times, however, has also not escaped its scrutiny. They've had their own issues recently. And in particular, there's been a pretty clear line of succession. Editors Joe Kahn, James Bennett, Cliff Levy have all been names that have emerged to succeed the current executive editor. And I should mention the first Black executive editor at the New York Times, who's Dean Baquet. That line of succession appears to be shaken up a little bit. There was recently, Sarah, some reporting about James Bennett in particular by a former person who'd worked with him. So what do we know about the turmoil at the New York Times right now?
Well, people have been looking for Dean Baquet's successor from the moment that he stepped into that job. So succession races at the New York Times hold a particular kind of fascination for people. What's happening now, I mean, obviously James Bennett left the New York Times in the wake of the very controversial Tom Cotton op-ed. And that was over the summer at a period of time when newsrooms were in turmoil following the protests after George Floyd's death. And that was a moment where newsrooms, those protests really awakened something in newsrooms that had been lying dormant for a long time. So what happened after James Bennett is that people really woke up to the fact, and in the Times in particular, you turn around and you look, who are our other successors and who are the people who might be able to take over this job? And all of those successors are white men. And in this moment, that's a glaring lens on the world to just look and say that the people we have set up to succeed our editor, there are no people of color. There are no women in those ranks. Now, they've since expanded that pool a bit, but there's all kinds of questions around the New York Times and the kinds of people that get supported and promoted.
Sarah, one of the things that notably is happening at the Times is also a bit of a shakeup among personnel who are not in line for Dean Baquet's job. We know that there were two notable departures just very recently from the Times. What can you tell us about that, Sarah?
Well, right. In the same week, Andy Mills, who was a producer on the incredibly popular podcast, The Daily, and was working on Caliphate, which was an incredibly popular program that they had supported, that sort of blew up. Andy Mills was the producer on that show, and he left after their allegations surfaced that he had, you know, had exhibited behavior that was close to sexual harassment, bullying. There were reports that women had raised about him in his previous jobs, and he left the Times. Separately, Don McNeil, who is also somebody who's become a leading voice on the pandemic, he's a major public health voice on the coronavirus, a report surfaced in the Daily Beast about his behavior on a Putney student travel trip where students complained about him, you know, talking down to them, talking down to Indigenous leaders on the trip, and notably using the N-word in a conversation. And that was something that the Times had investigated back in 2019 and reprimanded him. But then when those reports became public, the staff again was really troubled by the fact that no further action was taken. And so Don McNeil was forced to resign on the same week. And it really, those two departures opened up a question at the Times that, again, has been there for a long time, lying dormant, but is now very much out in the open.
We should also mention in full transparency that Andy Mills previously worked at WNYC, which is the producer for this show. We can't ignore television. NBC News has made some big changes. They now have Cesar Conde, who is a Latino, leading MSNBC and CNBC, as well as NBC News. He came over from Telemundo. MSNBC Rashida Jones will be the first woman of color to lead a major cable news company when she becomes the president of MSNBC. So there have been lots of changes in television. And of course, we have CNN, who is also my previous employer, where Jeff Zucker is reportedly on the way out. So big changes there. What do we see? Is there anyone that we're thinking who could replace Jeff Zucker at CNN right now? Is it too early?
It's a little early. Jeff Zucker, you know, himself addressed the staff because there were so many rumors that he was going to step down kind of now. And he announced that he was going to stay through the end of his contract. So he's there another year. It gives a long, long runway for him to, for them to find a successor. But there's no question that these changes in the television landscape, you know, again, this is an industry that has predominantly been run by white men. And now there are new leaders, as you mentioned, at MSNBC and at NBC, who are taking over. And there's a real clamoring for a new generation of leadership and people who are going to be able to look at stories without some of the blind spots that have long existed in media. And so, you know, James Goldston at ABC News also announced his retirement. And so we're really going to see, you know, television in a way shapes the culture a bit more than even the print news organizations that we've been talking about. So those changes in leadership are going to be significant in terms of what people see on their television sets and the stories that people, that those news organizations are choosing to air. I think that we're really going to see, you know, we'll have to be on the lookout for how that might change the programming in the months and years to come.
I think one of the things I'm noticing both at a local television and network and even cable television, Sarah, is that there are more correspondents of color who are emerging. And I think that that's an interesting thing mm-hmm. to see as we move forward, particularly in White House correspondent jobs and big jobs like that. You've written that this could be a crisis or an opportunity for journalism. Where do you stand right now?
Well, it seems, you know, at the beginning when these jobs all came open and you kept hearing the same names come up about who could succeed these leaders, it felt like newsrooms were not prepared and had not been grooming a broad base of people who could step into these jobs. Now we've seen over the past months, as you mentioned, a much more diverse crop of people coming up to cover the White House and White House correspondence jobs. So newsrooms are trying to rise to this challenge and turn it into something. And so I have faith that one, people won't abide a new crop of leaders that isn't more diverse, that doesn't elevate more women and people of color. And I think that this is a moment, you know, people talk about in business all the time that personnel is policy. And so I think that that's sort of what we are testing right now, where if you can put the right people in those jobs and you can put a more diverse crop of candidates, what's that going to do to the news that people are consuming? And I think that most of these news organizations feel a real responsibility and an urgency that they need to define the kind of leaders that they need to have more broadly. It used to be there was a very narrow path for how you would succeed at a news organization. And now those news organizations are doing so many more things than old newspapers used to do. There are podcasts. These are 24-hour multimedia operations. The kinds of talents and the talent pool you can draw from, you can be much more creative and more broad thinking than what people have been for many, many years. So I think that there's a real opportunity here for people to expand their searches and think pretty creatively about who might be the next round of leaders for these organizations.
Well, we'll soon find out what they decide to do. Sarah Ellison is a staff writer for The Washington Post covering media and politics. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC. Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Back with you on The Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're going to end this show with a topic that's been puzzling me. Need a clue? The answer is nine letters across and something that's become a staple of the nation's leading newspapers. If you guess crossword puzzle, you're probably one of the many people listening who spends their weekend mornings solving the New York Times popular crossword puzzles, whether it's by pen, pencil, or smartphone. But like many other parts of the news industry, for years, crosswords have largely been written and edited by older white men, and they've determined who and what makes it onto the grid, often excluding women and people of color and the LGBTQ plus community in the construction and content of crosswords. So how can we get the crossword world to become more inclusive and think outside the box, or in this case, the 15 by 15 grid? So how can the crossword world become more inclusive and think outside the box, or in this case, the 15 by 15 grid? For that and more, I'm joined by Kay Austin Collins, a film critic at Rolling Stone and crossword constructor for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and more. Cameron, welcome back to the show.
Hi there.
So that's a pretty amazing gig that you've got there. How did you get into crossword puzzles?
My mom solved them for most of my childhood, and then like everyone else who starts out getting published, I was just freelancing. I was submitting and submitting to the New York Times and getting rejected and rejected. And then after a couple of years of that, I got my first puzzle in.
So what makes you like crosswords? Like, why was that the medium that you thought, you know, was the one to sort of lean into?
Honestly, I'm you know, it's funny you ask, because I'm much more of a constructor than a solver. I do solve the daily puzzle in the Times, but for me, it's like the same as refurbishing furniture or any kind of craft hobby. You know, it's making something, it's thinking, but you also have a flow state where, for me, it's just, you know, I step back and a few hours later I have a grid. I can't really explain it. It's just sort of a relaxing thing for me.
It's a flow. I personally am terrified of doing some of these crosswords. But you are one of several Black crossword constructors who was recently featured in the New York Times as part of its celebration of Black constructors. When we think about race in crosswords, and in particular the constructor role here, tell us how not diverse the community is.
Well, I think part of the reason that we had a Black Constructors Week last week this year, and last year we had the same for Women's History Month, we had a Women's Constructors Week, is because the diversity issue is a bit lacking. For Black Constructors Week, we only had, out of the 7 days, we only had six constructors, because the two of us who might have been available to do a Sunday puzzle had to be slotted for other days. Just to give you an example, we did have a seventh Black constructor run this week, But it just gives you a sense of it was a very, very small pool. And the New York Times puzzle runs every day of the year. So, you know, it could afford to be more diverse. I mean, at the New Yorker, for example, two of the six constructors featured in the New York Times last week are on the staff at the New Yorker. And the New Yorker staff has many, many, many fewer people available to it than the New York Times does. So it, you know, it's not the most diverse crowd, and that's something that we're working on. That's something that people are going out of their way to, for example, mentor younger constructors of color, women. I'm getting more women doing Friday and Saturday puzzles, which is when themeless puzzles run, which historically have been very, very, very male. You know, thinking about these things, because there's just really no reason why, there's just no science behind the idea that making crosswords appeals to some races more than others. It really is a matter of who feels like this is something they can do, who feels like it's something that they're invited to do.
Well, let's talk about the clues themselves. And for some reason, I think often about things like standardized tests, you know, where those have been criticized often for not necessarily their difficulty, but for presenting word problems and other things that are really disconnected to the students that might be taking those tests, particularly if they haven't had certain life experiences and the rest. And I wonder if crosswords are the same. Are the clues that we see often reflective of the lack of diversity in the crossword constructing world? And if so, how do we see that potentially changing?
Well, they absolutely can be. And, you know, I give you an example of that. You could have the name, for example, Carl in a puzzle, or another good one is D-E-E, three letters. For me, my instinctive way to clue that would be in terms of Ruby D or Billy D. Williams. And for another constructor who doesn't have that in mind, it could be any number of other things, which is fine. But when you do that with everything in the puzzle that does have that leeway, when you opt for, you know, a white reference or an older reference, you know, you can clue the name John any number of ways, but he's been clued as Lennon too many times. And it does make a bit of a difference. And then also just, you know, if you put Beyonce in a puzzle, or if you put, Rita Moreno in a puzzle or whatever, these are choices that, their names that take up a bit of space, and you're probably more inclined to include these people if you care about them. So who you are, but really also what you care about and what you're sensitive to, all of that plays a role. And the idea for me is for all of us, no matter who you are, to represent a diversity of things in our grids, because they're solved by a diversity of people, but we aren't all thinking in those terms.
There are people listening now who are probably saying, Cameron, what's the secret to solving crossword puzzles? And since you construct them, do you have any advice?
Yeah, I always start with two things. I look for all the fill in the blanks, because those are usually pretty easy.
Okay.
And I look for all the proper nouns that I might know, because those are nowhere to don't. So if you know who wrote this song or whatever is being clued, start with that stuff, and the wordplay will come later.
Have you ever gotten pushback for any of your clues? Or people said, we didn't know who this person was?
I've gotten a lot of that. I've gotten a lot of pushback for naughtiness in the puzzle. I put Cuddle Buddy in the New York Times once, and someone said it made them very uncomfortable, which I feel for them. It's quite sad to me. But yeah, I've gotten all kinds of pushback, frankly.
I'm sure you have. Kay Austin Collins is a film critic at Rolling Stone and crossword constructor for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and more. Cameron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, that's it for us today. Thanks as always to the team who makes this show every day. And this week we give special kudos to our director and sound designer, Jay Cowett, who is moving frenetically around the control room, doing three jobs as one person. Our deepest thanks to him. Alexandra Botti is our senior producer. Vince Fairchild is our board operator. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Our line producer is Jackie Martin. And our producer crew is Amber Hall, Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Patricia Jacob, and Lydia McMullen Laird. David Gable is our executive assistant. Lee Hill is our executive producer. And we hope he's having a great time on vacation this week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thank you.